Hi there and hello there. This is the David Martinez podcast coming to you on October the 29th. I guess just a few days before Halloween. It's about time I did another one of these. You know, it's been a few weeks. I have my reasons. I've got my excuses. Last weekend, busyness. Weekend before, you know, we had a bit of a trip with some family and with my wife to Las Vegas, and I don't need to explain these things to you guys. Reflections on my previous and first podcast. You listen back to it, and you know, you sort of criticize yourself. I'm not always of the opinion that, you know, your harshest critic is yourself. Sometimes you're your easiest critic, but, you know, I can see where you might get that impression. You're kind of harder on yourself on certain things that other people may not necessarily be so hard on. You listen back, like, oh, why did I say that? Oh, why did I use that word? Doesn't even mean that thing that I wanted it to mean. Why did I say that thing? So there's a lot of that listening back, like, it's a lot of dead air, a lot of ums and a lot of stupid pauses. And, you know, I remember listening back thinking, like, I know why so many people who they interview on the street, on the news, or they call into radio shows and they all sound like complete morons. Because it's hard. It's hard for someone just to throw a mic in your face and say, okay, and just talk. Just sort of talk in a straight line. There's just sort of collecting your thoughts and then thinking about what you want to say. You know, when you're having a conversation, it's different. You know, there's a lot of back and forth. You know, you're sort of speaking to, you know, inform somebody about one particular thing. Usually you're prompting some kind of response, you know, unless you're sort of telling a story. But in most conversation, you don't have that practice of just speaking sort of linearly and, you know, having all your thoughts nicely organized. You know, I guess people who, you know, sort of are trained in public speaking, you know, people, you know, public speakers, motivational speakers, television personalities, radio personalities, stand-up comedians, you know, they all have this sort of training. And most people, myself included, just do not. And so we go up there. And just, there was a noise. It sounded like firecrackers. And the TV was on. I just ran. They're telling a story. And you're like, who did they get for this thing? But I get it now. I get it because I'm that guy who just heard a noise. And it really has nothing to add to the story. So that's where I'm at with this. Okay. Also listening back to, the whole podcast thing, made me realize I need to plan this sort of stuff better. Originally when I was doing it, I wanted this to sound like a casual and candid conversation, or just not even a conversation, just somebody speaking sort of candidly and casually about things. I didn't want it to sound like somebody just sort of, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to read this essay of things that I wrote, or, you know, this isn't, or, you know, I'm not reciting a speech. I'm just talking. That was kind of the whole how I wanted it to sound. So, you know, initially it was, all right, we'll just write a couple points and then just sort of talk, you know. And then partially because I was lazy. I didn't want to really think about it too much more than that. I'll be honest. That maybe had more to do with it than I'm really willing to admit. But it was what it was. So after listening back, I'm like, you know, I really should take some notes and just kind of think about it a little more and maybe go over it in my mind a little bit. You know, it doesn't have to turn into a speech. It doesn't have to turn into this thing where I stick to my points and I have points and subpoints. I don't know if any of you ever took like a speech class in college. I took one. It was just immensely annoying because it really had a lot less to do with, you know, how to speak publicly and how to deliver a speech, and a lot more with how to prepare your notes. And I just found that so infuriating. Maybe that's what sort of drives some of this. Moving on. So this episode is brought to you by McCarthy's Single Malt. It is something I picked up the other day. It's a nice little whiskey from Oregon, actually. story is a guy in Oregon, he's been doing this whole craft distilling thing in America for quite a bit longer than a lot of these newer distilleries. And his whole recipe is he takes malt, you know, for this is purely for whiskey people, so anybody else can just kind of skip this as of right now. But anyhow, for the for those of you who remain, he comes and he goes and he takes, he has peated barley from Scotland. He imports that to his distillery in Oregon. It is then sort of made into a sort of beer-like mash by the brewers over at Widmer Brothers Brewing Company, for those of you who are familiar with sort of beer and beer name brands. And then it is distilled. He has his own little distilling machine, distiller, distillating apparatus. And then it is made into whiskey. He then will barrel it for a year. In one particular type of barrel, then barrel it in another barrel for another year, and then barrel it in one final barrel for a third year, and then it's a finished product. I know one of the barrels, I believe, is supposed to be a sherry cask. One, I think, is probably American bourbon. I don't think there's any other kind of bourbon. My Canadian friends might disagree. And then finally, I think the last one is fresh Oregon white oak. The result, I'm not... you know, a tremendous expert on the subject, but my somewhat lay opinion on it, it's kind of a lesser complicated version of those really rich, smoky, salty kind of Islay, you know, a region sort of scotches. You know, it's got a bit of that, but it's definitely a lot less complicated, a lot more subdued, very sort of light and very easy to drink. I kind of liken it to something like a summer Islay malt, just something you can drink on a hot day that's not too oppressive. Even the color is just a really nice pale gold. You know, if you put it in a clear glass on a sunny day and, you know, put it on a piece of dark, you know, dark wood table, it would probably look very picturesque. So, you know, there's that. And I've actually been enjoying that very much lately. You can traditionally, it's been kind of hard to find. I, you know, usually only have so many cases of it and they're gone almost right away. But I guess Total Wine has recently picked them up, and so I've seen them at the Total Wine in Torrance off of Hawthorne Boulevard there in Torrance, California, and also at the Total Wine in Rancho Cucamonga, which obviously is also in California. So that's that as far as that subject is concerned. Subject number two. So the other day, there's that song by that girl, I don't even know how to pronounce her name right. Lourdes. She's a Kiwi. She's from New Zealand. I'll be your ruler. You're gonna marry Queen Bee. Yeah, that, okay. Hopefully that will tell, you know, you'll know the song by now if I've just repeated that. Some blogger went on some rant criticizing her because, you know, I feel like those lyrics were very racist because clearly she's referring to a particular ethnic group when she's saying some of those things. And, you know, I just think that people just really need to be aware of just how racist this is. And, you know, this particular blogger just came under this huge fire. Just everyone saying like, well, obviously you're very racist if you're the only one reading that kind of, you know, reading that into these lyrics, you know. So this person kind of came under a tremendous amount of fire for that, and I certainly didn't agree with her either. But it just kind of made me think about how we're kind of weird about race in this country. And when I say weird, I feel like there's two groups of people that I'm referring to, and both of those two people will probably, and it's kind of more of a spectrum rather than you're sort of in this group or you're not in one of these groups. You know, it's more of a spectrum, I guess, than rather a group of people. But depending on where you're at in the spectrum, when I say we're weird about race in this country, you'll probably have one of two reactions. Either you'll say like, oh yeah, we're totally weird. Like, you know, I can't believe that we're still so, that racism is still such a problem in this country. And that, you know, just the other day I heard somebody telling a story, and in the story they said like the guy was Asian. Like, why is that important that he was Asian? You know, like, you know, so clearly we're still very weird in this country about race. So you're either in that category, or you're in the category of like, yeah, dude, like, why is everyone such a big deal about it? You know, all that crap happened a long time ago. Get over it, you know? And so there is kind of that spectrum of, you know, of weirdness. And I feel like most of the time people, I don't know whether it's that people can't find a balance. You know, most people immediately always think like, oh, you always just need to find a balance. And they, maybe there is a balance that needs to be struck, but maybe it's both ends of that particular spectrum just think about race too much. You know what I mean? It's just too much of something you think about. I remember a gentleman, a guy I correspond with over the phone a lot, or I used to more, a Canadian guy, really nice guy. He was telling me the story about how he was getting his roof done or something, or roof or windows or some kind of treatments on his home. And there was a guy who was, you know, giving him a quote for it. And the gentleman happened to be a black man. And, you know, the guy was going, oh, well, you can get treatments that are this way or this color or this, that, and you can get some black ones. And the guy made some silly joke about, you know, a black shingles, and he was a black guy. The person telling the story didn't even tell me what the joke was, but it was something along those lines. And then he kind of, you know, indicated to me, he's like, oh yeah. And I was so bummed, you know, that he felt like he needed to, you know, mention race and that he was a black guy. And oh, it was just such a thing. And I remember just thinking like, so what? You know, it'd be one thing if you took it upon yourself to point that out about somebody, because you don't, you know, A, you don't know this guy. You don't know where his sensibilities or his sensitivities may be on the subject. So that could be very rude. And, you know, obviously I'm sure a lot of people would probably say racist as well, but you know, he was a black guy and they were black shingles or whatever they were. And there's an obvious, if not a particularly clever or funny, but there's an obvious joke there. So if, you know, he decided to take upon himself to say the joke, fine, who cares? You know, I sometimes get the impression from people who are, and you, some of you are going to have to forgive me for using this term, but for people who are very, I guess, quote, progressive in this way, that the perfect world would be one in which I'm a shopkeep and, or somebody, and somebody is telling, you know, and a gentleman walks into the place to buy some goods, and it takes me a good solid 15, 20 minutes before I even notice that he happens to be an Asian man or a black man, because it's just so far removed from the way I look at people that I don't even notice these sort of things. And I can't really imagine that's the way it's supposed to be. I mean, at the end of the day, we're not blind. Obviously, some people look and, you know, are sort of different from each other. My wife had we were having this conversation the other day, and she had a really good quote. And she said, the opposite of being racist isn't being colorblind. The opposite of being racist is not being colorblind. You know, I think a more casual and a more friendly, sort of idea about race is probably better. And some of you people think, you know, differently of what exactly that looks like. And again, I probably couldn't paint a perfect picture of it either. The closest thing that comes to mind was, I worked at this particular, it was like they sold like, it was a forklift dealership. It was a large, it was a pretty decent sized company. They had a few branch locations. It was a friend of the family's, and I worked in their parts department. And the parts department was, you know, composed of, there was a couple of middle-aged white guys, a couple of younger, you know, 20, 30 something Hispanic guys. There was an older black gentleman. There was this, older sort of, Japanese fellow. And I remember one of the things that sort of struck me about it is just how much they did talk about race, you know, in a joking and sort of friendly manner, a lot of those sort of your people kind of jokes. You know, I mean, you know, not so much that was exclusively what they talked about, but I mean, it was mixed in with, you know, conversation about sports and about work and about this particular guy and, you know, why he, you know, was probably going to be fired or, you know, it was just something that was talked about casually like any other subject. It was something that, you know, they weren't blind to and just so oblivious to, but it was also something that they could just speak on lightly and casually and you know, easily and just sort of joke about. And it was no big deal one way or the other. You know, they obviously noticed that they were different from each other, not just in sort of those very, you know, superficially, you know, features and, you know, color wise, but even just sort of culturally and background wise, they were different. And, you know, being forced to work in a common environment, you know, it just made those differences very unimportant. Chesterton, who's, you know, somebody I like to sort of quote a bit, a lot of insight there. You know, he mentioned once that for him, the essence of democracy was that the things that differentiate men, the things that are that men have in common, are infinitely more important, and infinitely more maybe extraordinary than the things that make them different. And that was the essence of democracy. And again, I you know, when I see people who can speak casually and easily about it, not that it's always on their mind, but when it does come up, there's not sort of tiptoeing around the subject and walking on eggshells around it. You know, to me, that speaks more about what is closer to how we should regard the subject than just like, oh, I didn't, you know, I just don't even think about it ever. Like, it's just something that's not even on my mind, you know, like at all. And I just can't think, you know, I don't think that's really necessarily the way we have to go about it. On the other hand, you know, there are people that I've met who, you know, were like, oh, dude, totally agree. Like, I'm always joking with my friends about, like, you know, the race and stuff. And, like, it's, like, no big deal, you know. And I find that people who are a little too eager to talk about it usually fall into the category of, yeah, race is no big deal, except my race. Yeah, you know, cultural differences are no big deal unless you're talking about mine. And so, obviously, you know, that's certainly not the way to go. You know, and I guess really the idea is, I don't quite know what the perfect picture would look like, but something along the lines of, we're not oblivious, we're not sort of willfully, you know, blind to things that are plainly in front of us, but at the same time, it doesn't have to be so preoccupying one way or the other. You know what I mean? And it's just, we just think about it too much. And I think that's what makes us weird in this country about it. Either we think about it too much in the sense that we are, you know, what is traditionally considered racist, or we think about it too much in the sense that we're just, okay, I can't, oh gosh, I shouldn't say that. That was probably racist. That was probably racist. You know, I can't think that either way is a healthy direction. And again, I don't know that a balance between the two is necessarily good. It's really just a matter of, let's just not think about it so much. So, you know, anyway, that's with that particular subject. So, point number two, because now I have a list. In keeping with my previous topic, I'm staying organized here. I'm trying to stay on track. Self-proclaimed snobs. I don't know if this is a relatively new thing or if it's just new with, as I'm getting older, it's just something I'm seeing more and more often. I was in a coffee shop the other day over in Arcadia. Lovely little place, nice coffee. I think coffee came from some town from Portland. Anyhow, great Belgian waffles, nice. I'm looking at the menu and they have an option up there for donut snob donuts. Donut snob donuts. And it struck me, and it took me a little while to really, you know, think about in my mind, like, what I didn't like about that and why that was just sort of weird to me. Number one, if you're ordering the donut, I really tend to think that snobbery should really just go out the window for you. You're getting a donut. You know, just the very definition of just cheap, you know, everyday guy pastry. Just, it's a donut. Get over it. Get over yourself. I couldn't have conceived in my mind that there was such a thing as a donut snob. You know? you know, like in my mind, I can't imagine there's some, such a thing as perhaps a reality TV snob, you know, or a macaroni and cheese snob. Well, maybe macaroni and cheese, but who knows? You know, just it's just not the kind of thing that should really lend itself to snobbery. It's a donut. Get over it. But there's a lot of that sort of going around that people find very acceptable because they tend to equate being a snob or snobbery with having better taste in things. And I don't know. I don't necessarily agree with that. I don't think that really tracks. I think number one, the two are completely different things. You can be a snob and not really have good taste because you're just sort of very particular and fastidious about things. And you can be somebody who has good taste, but not necessarily a snob. You know, you have taste enough to recognize when something is good and when something is of quality, you know, when you're, you know, eating a good meal or drinking a good, you know, wine or, you know, coffee or whatever it happens to be. But you're not necessarily a slave to that either. You know, you're not, you know, making yourself difficult to please. And I guess that's probably one of the first problems I have with these sort of self-proclaimed snobs. And I see it more now, you know, more and more now, people who call themselves beer snobs or this snob or that snob or coffee snobs or whatever it is. And, you know, it's hard for me to, why would you want to make yourself intentionally difficult to please? I mean, I say that rhetorically. I know why, you know, I know in my heart why you would do that. You do that because you feel like in some way it reflects well on you. And so you make yourself difficult to artificially sort of difficult to please in one or more particular areas. And you call it snobbery and you think that, you know, well, this is just as due to my, you know, elevated taste in this one particular thing or other. But again, it's not. It's one thing to be able to appreciate good things. It's another thing to always need them. Typically it's a good thing because you don't need one more thing to be arrogant and prideful and a prick about. And I think that, you know, calling yourself a snob just kind of feeds that part of us. There's almost nothing that we can do, nothing that we can enjoy, nothing that we, can know about ourselves that can't be a source of pride and arrogance. And I think when you're putting the label of snob on yourself about a particular thing, you're intentionally feeding into that and intentionally giving, you know, sort of power to that in yourself. And I think so that for that reason, that's obviously bad. And for the more, you know, for the sort of more mean or practical reason that you can't always get the good stuff, you know. I may have some appreciation for what makes a good beer or a better whiskey or a better cigar or better coffee or whatever. I might, and some, you know, to varying degrees. And of course, some, you know, better than some, not as good as others. But at the same time, you know, I can still enjoy something a little less expensive, a little more practical, something that's a little more accessible to friends of mine whom, may not know or may not be as interested in this one particular thing as I am, and still enjoy myself. You know, obviously the nicer thing might be my preference, but I don't make myself intentionally difficult to please. And I remember I was at a friend's house once and, kind of in line with this is why I kind of feel this way about it. And it was a longtime friend of mine and they had beer there and it was some very light, cheap lager, like, you know, Nat Ice or, you know, Coors Light or something along those lines. And they said, oh, you know, I hope that's okay. They kind of approached me in a somewhat embarrassed way. Like, I hope it's okay that we just have this. Like, is that going to be a problem? And I felt bad. You know, for those of you who know me know that I beer is one of the things that I do love and I love learning more about and I love trying a lot of, and it's, you know, new things and new flavors and new, you know, ways of doing it are always very interesting to me. But it saddened me that the way I put it out there was such that it made this person feel like, oh gosh, like maybe like they needed to sort of, you know, measure up in a way or they felt excluded was kind of the way. And I really feel like if your taste in something makes people feel excluded, you're doing it wrong. And I think that's probably the best way to put it. If you're tasting something, whatever it is, even if it's something, you know, music, you know, art, you know, travel, food. I mean, there's a billion and one subjects out there. if your taste in that is one that makes people feel excluded, and secretly that's kind of one of the things you sort of enjoy about it, you're doing it wrong. You're absolutely doing it wrong. When I enjoy these things with friends, I love bringing people into it. When I genuinely love the thing, I love the thing, not how the thing reflects on me, and I want to bring people into it, not push people out and keep it this exclusive and esoteric thing that only me and my other friends here sort of... No, it shouldn't be like that. It should never be like that. So, you know, for those of you who, you know, like to put the label of snob on yourself for one or two particular things, you're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong. You're being that guy, I guess. Another Chesterton quote. I'll close it on this particular one. Was that fastidiousness? And fastidiousness can mean a few things, but one of the things it can mean is somebody who's sort of very particular or difficult to please. Fastidiousness is the most pardonable of vices, but it is the most impardonable of virtues. It's the most pardonable of vices, but the most impardonable of virtues. In that he was talking about something slightly different, but the core to his meaning is that as long as you regard that as something that's wrong with yourself, it's understandable. It's excusable. We all have it in one way or another. I get it. You know, it's kind of the sentiment. But is the second you try to turn that into a virtue, something you're proud of yourself about, it becomes something completely different and completely inexcusable. So anyhow, that's pretty much it. So, all right. Well, that's pretty much all the time material I have for tonight. I hope you guys enjoyed yourselves. I hope maybe this time it was a bit more, not so full of pauses and using the wrong words for things as I was last time. And thank you so much for listening. All right. Have a good day.